Welcome to the Sci-Fi Show, where we talk science and philosophy with the premier atheist philosophers Alex Malpass and Dan Linford. But today we have our first ever guest on the show, and it's none other than Joe Schmidt. Joe is a force of nature. He's published more than a dozen papers in leading journals, two books, one of which was co-authored with our very own Dan Linford, and a lot of this as an undergraduate. He's currently working on his PhD in philosophy at Princeton, and perhaps most importantly, is an Arsenal fan, which is my local football team. So how are you doing, Joe?
Amazing. I'm very excited for this, and I'm also excited for the upcoming year for Arsenal. I think we're going to win the league, so yeah.
Well, it's funny. I was talking to my brother about it, and he says, right now, Arsenal's at the top of the league. And I'm like, how come? The league's over. And he goes, it's alphabetical.
Yes.
So, exactly. Yeah, let's hope. All right. So one reason we wanted Joe on the show was because he and Alex have just had a paper accepted in Mind, which is one of the leading philosophy journals in the world. And it's related to the Kalam cosmological argument, which argues from the beginning of the universe to God. So in our last show, we saw Frank Turek do an embarrassingly bad attempt at defending some of this argument. But there is a new version of the argument, which involves some very strange paradoxes that I think we have to take a lot more seriously. So, Joe, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what this paper is about?
Yeah, so as you said, it's forthcoming in Mind, and the title is Benedetti Paradoxes, Causal Finitism, and the Unsatisfiable Paradiagnosis. And surely you're going to be linking it in the description, so if the audience wants to read it, they can check it out. So yeah, it'll be linked down there. And yeah, basically what we do in the paper is we sort of examine two competing solutions to a certain family of paradoxes. And the competing solutions are, on the one hand, causal finitism, which says that nothing can have infinitely many causes. And then the other solution is what we call the unsatisfiable paradiagnosis, following another philosopher, Nicholas Shackle. And this unsatisfiable paradiagnosis, or UPD for short, says that the family of paradoxes are uniformly impossible simply because of their logical structure, and we don't need to adopt any substantive metaphysical thesis in order to avoid them or in order to solve them. And we basically argue in the paper that the UPD enjoys lots of pretty significant theoretical advantages over causal finitism as a solution to these sorts of paradoxes. And of course, we also address perhaps two of the biggest objections to the UPD that have been raised by other philosophers. So that's just a kind of bird's eye overview.
Right. So why don't we start, Alex, with what these paradoxes are? The most famous one is the Grim Reaper paradox. So maybe we can tell us about that.
Yeah, okay. So the Grim Reaper paradox is a slightly more recent version of it. So it dates back to maybe slightly before this, but certainly to Rob Koons' 2014 paper, which I think is called something like Grim Reaper Paradox, Revenge of the Kalam, something like that. Anyway, and what he's doing really is reapplying a previous type of paradox. So the paradox goes back before Koons. He didn't make it up. It's credited with coming from Jose Bernadetti. So he's philosopher who was active in the 50s and 60s. He wrote this book. It's an amazing book called something I can't remember. Joe, can you remember?
Infinity, an Essay in Metaphysics.
Yeah, there we go, which is a wild ride. It's a very fun and interesting book to read. And in that, he explores lots of crazy things. But in particular, he advances this type of paradox, a bit like Zeno's paradox. So people might be familiar with that about there's different versions of that, but they all sort of exploit the idea of converging sequences. So, you know, think about the tortoise and the hare. So the hare, you know, runs twice as fast as the tortoise, but, you know, in the time that the hare takes to run, you know, this interval, the tortoise has run half of it and blah, 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 whatever. It's all about this converging sequence of different versions of Zeno's paradox. And this Benedetti paradox sort of exploits a similar thing, but it works in a slightly different way to the standard Zeno's paradoxes. So while, you know, you can play around with lots of fanciful different illustrations for this, I think the one I like to give when I'm trying to explain this to my dad or someone in the pub or something, is you imagine someone who's trying to walk along a straight line from point A to point B, and he's at point A right now, about to take his first step. And he doesn't realize it, but there is some supernatural entity located at the halfway point who's determined to prevent the man from getting the whole way there. And should the man arrive at just before the halfway point, then this being will make a wall appear from nothing, you know, creation ex nihilo, an impassable wall will block the man's progress. So he's definitely not going to complete the journey from point A to point B, because this guy will make a wall appear that will prevent him from getting there. But also he doesn't realize that there's another supernatural entity that's at the quarter of the waypoint. And he's got the same idea. If the guy gets as far as him, he's going to make an impassable wall appear as well. And also there's another one lying in wait at the eighth of the way, and another one at the 16th of the way, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this, like, we've got this journey. The guy wants to get from point A to point B, but at the halfway point, something's going to stop him from getting further. Also at the quarter of the way point, the eighth of the way, blah, blah, blah. And so we're cramming in an infinite sequence of these beings that are going to prevent him from going any further. So now ask yourself, is he going to make it from point A to point B? Well, obviously, no, he's not going to do that because, I mean, pick one of the guys, you know, there's infinitely many entities that will be preventing him from getting any further. On the other hand, for each one, right, to say the halfway point one, he's not going to prevent the man's path because, I mean, the man's not going to make it to the halfway point because he would have had to have crossed through an infinite number of reapers in order to get there. What reapers or whatever these entities are, right? So he's not going to make it as far as the halfway point. We definitely know that. So then we can rule that one out. But also he's not going to make it as far as the quarter of the way point either for the same reason. There's just as many of these things that are going to prevent him going that way too. So this applies to every single one of those beings, crazily. So although we're completely certain he's not going to make it from point A to point B, it's also true that for none of the beings that will prevent him, is that the one that will actually do the manifestation of the wall, right? So it's bizarre. It just feels like something weird and crazy that's going on. So hopefully that sort of illustrates. I mean, the Grim Reaper version of this, just very quickly, is just same idea, exactly the same idea. Just imagine that there's between, you know, instead of a space, which is think about the interval between, you know, 12 o'clock and 1 o'clock, and at 12:30, there's a reaper, he'll kill Fred if Fred's still alive at that point. At 12:15, there's a reaper, he'll kill Fred if Fred's still alive at that point. At the whatever it is, 12:07, there's another reaper there, he'll kill Fred if he makes it that far. And again, same thing, is he going to make it to 1 o'clock? No, obviously, because there's infinitely many reapers, they will kill him. But on the other hand, none of the reapers are such that they in particular will kill him. So we have exactly the same paradox there. So hopefully that's the general idea of a Benedetti paradox.
And then, Dan, can you just explain what on earth has this got to do with the Kalam cosmological argument?
You know, again, as we said before, the Kalam cosmological argument is an argument that tries to go from the beginning of the universe to the existence of God as the cause of the universe. In order to establish that the universe has a beginning, one of the strategies we'll have employed is to try to show that past time is finite. Now, one way to go with the Bernardetti paradoxes, or with the Grim Reaper paradox in particular, is the thought that past time has to be finite for the following reason. So you can imagine Grim Reapers spread out through time, not through the kind of short period of time that Alex was talking about, but suppose that there's one Grim Reaper for every year. Well, then if that collection of Grim Reapers can't be infinite, then we're supposed to think that the number of past years must be finite. And if the number of past years is finite, then the thinking is supposed to go, the universe had a beginning. And so that's supposed to be the argument for the beginning of the universe. You can do the same thing, by the way, with causation. So you can say, instead of considering some chain of past years, we can consider some chain of past causes. And just as the chain of Grim Reapers is supposed to be finite, the causal chain is supposed to be finite. And if the chain of past causes is finite, then there must be a first one of them. There must be a first cause. So that, they think, is another way of establishing that the universe had a beginning. Some time when the first cause acted to create the universe.
So, Joe, can you unpack a little bit more about this notion of causal finitism? Versus the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis. What are these? Can you unpack what these concepts mean a bit more?
Yeah. So these are just basically theses or views. And one such view, as you said, is causal finitism. And causal finitism basically says that nothing can have infinitely many causes. So it's saying that it's impossible for there to be, for instance, an infinite regress of causes, because that would be one target state. being causally affected, whether directly or indirectly, by infinitely many past things. So causal finitism rules out infinite regresses of causes. Causal finitism also rules out infinite causal cooperation, so infinitely many distinct things causally impinging on a target state. So that's one thing, having infinitely many causes. According to causal finitism, both of those sorts of causal structures are impossible. So again, the thesis of causal finitism is that necessarily nothing has infinitely many causes. And this, of course, is offered as a solution to these sorts of Benedetti paradoxes, because the thought is that, well, hey, when we think about these kinds of Benedetti paradoxes, like the Grim Reaper paradox, all of them seem to involve the state of one Reaper, say, depending on the states, causally depending on the states of infinitely many previous Reapers. The Reaper basically is either going to kill Fred or not, depending on what the other Reapers do. So, and you can run this sort of reasoning with basically any sort of Benedetti paradox. All of them are going to have to involve some sort of causal sensitivity on the part of the Reapers or the gods laying down impassable walls or whatever. They're all going to involve some kind of causal sensitivity to the states of the previous gods or the previous Reapers who are acting to either kill Fred or to lay down a wall or whatever. So the thought is that all these Benedetti paradoxes seem to involve infinite causal chains, seem to involve infinite causal regresses, wherein one state causally depends on infinitely many previous states. And so if you can't have infinite causal regresses, as causal finitism says, then you kind of uniformly kill off all these Benedetti paradoxes. There's no threat of paradox arising whatsoever. And so the thought is that this offers a pretty unifying solution to Benedetti paradoxes. Now, there are other solutions on the market. One thing that we point out in the paper is that lots of other solutions, like, for instance, saying that motion is contradictory or other sorts of things, they actually don't solve the full breadth of Benedetti paradoxes. You can actually get a whole concoction of different kinds of Benedetti paradoxes, and we really want like a unifying solution. They all seem to have clearly something in common. They have this kind of same structure that unifies them. So we want a kind of unifying solution. And what we point out is that lots of other solutions, other than causal finitism and the UPD, which I'm about to explain, a lot of them don't actually offer unifying solutions. They don't uniformly kill all Benedetti paradoxes. Now, what's interesting is that we actually argue that causal finitism suffers from that same problem in the paper, but we'll get to that later. So let me just articulate the UPD then. This is the second candidate unifying solution that we consider in the paper. And it's pretty simple. It basically just says, listen, all these paradoxes are just uniformly logically impossible because they share a kind of abstract structure which no collection of things can satisfy. We don't need to take on any deep substantive metaphysical thesis like causal finitism or the finitude of the past or the contradictoriness of motion or anything like that. So it's a very kind of deflationary solution. It's basically just saying, in order to get the paradox, you have to assume that a certain collection of entities can satisfy a certain structure, but no collection of entities can satisfy that kind of structure. And that's all that we need to say to kill the paradox. Now, what is that structure? Maybe I'll turn it over to Alex to explain what that structure is.
Okay, yeah. So the way that Shackle sets this up, Shackle's paper is really, really super clear. And he has like a formal, it has a formal approach, which I think is crucial to the idea of the UPD, because basically the idea of the UPD is that there's a logical contradiction, and in order to demonstrate that properly, you have to kind of be clear about why, what's generating that contradiction. It's effectively a kind of structural thing, as Joe was saying. So for any mathematical structures are kind of things that logicians use on a daily basis, right? So it's a kind of model of points or whatever that have certain types of relations, and those things embody the logical relations that the system has. I mean, that's, don't worry if that doesn't make much sense. If you haven't studied formal logic, you won't know what I'm talking about. But basically, the way to think about it is just two conditions, right? So the first one just says there's a set of entities, doesn't matter what they are, they could be interpreted as times, as causes, as reapers, whatever that is, right? That is ordered in a line, right? So there's one after the other in a linear sequence, but in one direction it's closed, so there's a sort of ending one, and in the other direction it's open, so it just goes on and on and on without any end to it, right? There's no sort of first element in this sequence. So if you've got a structure like that in place, so it's a bit like the negative numbers, right? If you think about it like that. And then the other condition really just says for any one of these entities that's structured like that, there's some property P, doesn't matter what that is, such that each one has P if and only if none of the ones in the direction that's open have that property already. Right, so it's property P if and only if none of the earlier ones do, let's say. And that's just a very formalized way of saying, think about an infinite sequence of reapers going off into the depths of infinite time, one every year, as Dan was saying, and each one of them has this property such that he's killed Fred if and only if Fred hasn't already been killed by one of the reapers, right? That's just one version that satisfies these two conditions. We've got these two conditions, the beginninglessness condition, if you like, and Shackle calls it the unbegun condition, take your poison there. And then the other condition you can think about it as being the at, if not before condition.
Right? If and only, so if like, not before.
Yeah, that's true. and then the thought is just, well, once you've specified those two conditions clearly, you can just derive in a classical way, in classical logic, you can just derive the contradiction from them. So you don't actually need to interpret these as causes or times. It's not metaphysical. It's completely independent of how we interpret those. So, I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of people trying to respond to the to this kind of Grim Reaper argument by getting too into the specifics of how one of the versions of the illustration have been painted. So they'll be like, oh, well, it's about causation, it's something to do with, you know, if you can't have this one thing in the situation, then that gets out of it. But it's not about any of the details. You have to sort of take a step back from the details of any of those particular, it's not about walls or lines or invisible gods lying in wait, whatever. None of those details are actually crucial. The only thing that really matters is the structure. At least that's the thrust of the UPD diagnosis. It's basically saying everyone thinks this is metaphysical, but actually it's logical, and that's what the issue is.
Can I just see if I've got the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis right? Maybe we can give a football example. So I don't know how many games Arsenal are going to win next season, right? But I can guess a number. And Joe can probably guess a number. And what we could say is that I could guess more games than Joe, or Joe could guess more games than me. Both of those things are absolutely possible. But it's impossible that both of those things are right. It can't be that I name a number more than Joe and Joe names a number more than me. And those things just can't happen. Is that a fair way to describe it?
I mean, that is basically right. I just would say that it's not crucial to this analysis that either of those propositions themselves is in fact possible. I mean, it's completely irrelevant. The point is simply just that in combination, there's a logical contradiction there. Now, it may be that individually they're possible or impossible, but they just can't both be true together. So you can just tell there's no way that you could both, that the number of games you're thinking of is higher than the number of games that Joe's thinking of, and that the number of games that Joe's thinking of is higher than the number of games that you're thinking of. And that's just a straightforward logical fact. I mean, it may turn out that you're both in a coma or something and you couldn't possibly have formed those thoughts, right? But that's not relevant. The actual possibility goes slightly beyond the claim that the... So it's quite important. I'm being the hair splitty about it just because, you know, it's easy to think that you're committed to things that you're not. Like, the UPDS doesn't have to be committed to either of them being possible, just that they're not jointly possible.
Yeah, and I also wanted to add as well that the UPD is not merely the claim that these are jointly unsatisfiable. That is, it's logically impossible for them to be true together. At least as we characterize it in the paper, it is also the claim that no metaphysically substantive hypothesis need be posited in order to solve the Benedetti paradoxes, in addition to just noticing the joint logical unsatisfiability of the two conditions. So that's another important thing. And I did just kind of want to briefly get in a kind of analogy to this to help people see what exactly we're getting at. So imagine that I tell this story, you know, let's say Dan is going to come and join me at Princeton. Okay, he's going to come and we're going to have a fun day, and we're going to play some soccer, and we're going to watch an Arsenal game, and then we're going to debate philosophy. Okay, Dan and I get into a taxi. We're driving all around Princeton. I'm showing him the historic sites. I'm showing him the philosophy department, etc. And then we go back to the hotel. We debate some philosophy, and then we both go to sleep at separate places. Then we wake up And to one of us, let's say it's me, God appears. And it really is. This is part of the story. The God is dead, like definitely appearing to me. And God doesn't lie, okay? God does not lie. That's also part of the story. He always tells the truth. And he says to me, Joe, you haven't gotten into a taxi for the past week. Okay, end of story. Okay, so that's it's a very weird story. But I mean, let's think about that story. Hold on a second. According to the story, I did in fact get into a taxi with Dan the day before when we were going around Princeton. That's part of the story. But also part of the story is that God revealed to me that I had not gotten into a taxi for the past week. And moreover, part of the story is that God doesn't lie. He always tells the truth. And so we can derive this contradiction from the story that I just told. Namely, the contradiction that I both got into a taxi yesterday and I did not get into a taxi yesterday. Now, here's something that would be silly to conclude from this sort of thing. I guess, like, taxis are impossible. Or here's another thing that would be silly to conclude from this. Like, God is impossible. Another thing that's silly to conclude. It's impossible for me to get into a taxi. Another thing that's silly to conclude. It's impossible for God to reveal to me that I had never gotten into a taxi in the past week. For all my story said, all of those actually might be individually possible. The point to notice, though, is it's their combination that can't jointly happen. And we can treat this as like a cool paradox, you know, this paradox that I've just discovered. It's called the taxi paradox. And, oh, how are we to solve it? Should we adopt the impossibility of taxis? Should we like think that God's impossible? No, I think the best solution to this is a kind of unsatisfiable conjunction solution. It's that, listen, I have just told an inconsistent story. I've said various elements. Maybe they're each individually possible. Maybe it's possible for there to be taxis. Maybe it's possible for God to exist. Maybe it's possible for God to reveal that I've never gotten into a taxi in the past week. It's just that they can't all be true together. And we don't need to adopt any substantive hypothesis to solve this taxi paradox. So that's exactly how I view Benedetti paradoxes in general. Again, we can tell an inconsistent story involving infinity in some way, or involving infinite causal chains, or involving infinite past time. But all we can infer from that, so I say, and so we argue in the paper, is that you can't have that conjunction of elements being the case. You can't have an infinite chain, which is such that each of the members satisfies some condition or has some property if and only if none of the previous members have that property or satisfy that condition. You can't have that conjunction. It may very well be the case that you could nevertheless have some set which satisfies, you know, that condition, right? That each member of it satisfies P if and only if another previous one satisfies P. That may be possible individually. And it may also be possible individually for you to have an infinite collection of items or infinitely many pastimes or whatever. Really, just like the taxi case, all we should be able to infer from this, so I say, so we argue in the paper, is that it's the conjunction that's impossible and we don't need to adopt a substantive metaphysical hypothesis.
Right. So let me just So basically, then we've got two competing hypotheses, right? We've got this causal finitism and we've got this unsatisfiable pair diagnosis. Maybe, Dan, you could tell us a little bit. What's the problem with just going with causal finitism? Like, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. So the problem with just going with causal finitism is that it doesn't solve the problem as well as the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis does. So, for instance, there's a rule in logic called De Morgan's Law, and all it says is the following. So if I have a conjunction, two things that I want to say are true, so I can have A and B, that can be a true sentence, possibly. Of course, it could also be false. But for any two things, you can conjoin any two sentences, you can join them by putting an and in between them. And now suppose that I negate that entire sentence. I say that sentence can't be true. Well, what that I have not P and Q, what De Morgan's law tells us is that that's equivalent to not P or not Q. So if you have some collection of assumptions and you show that they can't all be true together, it doesn't tell you that any one of them in particular is false. What it tells you is that you can either have this one or this one, right? If there's two of them, or if there's three, you can have one of the three, possibly two of the three, depends upon how the contradiction comes about. And that allows you to solve that kind of problem without having to invoke something more metaphysically substantive. You don't have to commit yourself to, say, the discreteness of space, or there's only a finite number of past years, or all you have to point out is that whatever else is true, these sentences can't all be true together.
Right, so Alex, is there any other sort of issues with causal finitism? I mean, is it like a bigger metaphysical claim than the UPD?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a metaphysical claim, but the UPD doesn't make any, as far as we're understanding, it doesn't make any metaphysical claims, really. And those that it does are shared between the two hypotheses. For instance, the law of non-contradiction is true. I mean, some people think that's a metaphysical claim. So be it, though. It's shared between the two views. I think really the assumptions of the UPD are just a subset, the assumptions of causal finitism, possibly a proper subset, I suppose. But it does seem to us that there are independent reasons for not liking causal finitism, right? And you think of this as a kind of explosion problem or something. Maybe that's not the best word for it, right? But the point is that you can, you know, if you thought the Grim Reaper paradox showed you that time had a beginning, then the version I ran with in the first place, if it shows you anything, just shows you that time can't, that space can't be infinitely divided, right? That there must be some point at which some kind of quantum of space or something that you can't cut in half to fit yet more Reapers into. So it must show, if you like it, it shows that time has a beginning, also shows that space must be not infinitely divisible. You could also run the same arguments that we looked at to apply to space and time as well. So it must show that space has an edge and that time can't be infinitely divisible as well. And it's like all of a sudden we've got this like very strong sort of program that you could call spatio-temporal finitism. And it's a cluster of metaphysical views, in fact, not just one. It's not just the view that causes are, that causal chains are all finite. It's also that time and space are not infinitely divisible and that they both have an edge, right? Because Jacobus Erasmus has this version where, you know, the Grim Reapers are stood in a line, right? And each one will swing his scythe if and only if none of the ones to the left of them have done it, right? And does that show that space has an edge? I mean, come on, right? That seems a bit preposterous to me that you can make these sorts of huge, sweeping metaphysical conclusions just based on the analysis of a paradox, right? So Benedetti, you came up with this in the first place. Even though when I had this debate with Craig, he brought up Benedetti. I wish I had all of this worked out at the time as well. I could have reeled it off to him, but I wasn't thinking about the Grim Reaper paradox so much. But he said he wheeled out Benedetti as if he was on the same side as Craig. Actually, Benedetti's a defender of the actual infinite. I mean, that's...
Craig said something like, Benedetti said, look, there's no logical contradiction in infinity, but you only have to look at these paradoxes to tell you that they're metaphysically impossible.
Yeah, that's right? Just so really not what Benedetti says at all. I mean, it's because the opposite, in fact. He says, despite them looking so crazy, there's actually nothing that says that they can't be, they can all be kind of reconciled. You just have to wrap your brain around it in a new way. But he also has this idea that he thinks that the analysis of a paradox leading you to some conclusion like that, I think his idea is that you could determine just by analyzing a paradox whether the number of stars in the universe is even rather than odd or something. And you think that's preposterous. I think he says something like it's the worst extravagances of a priorism or something like that, right? He doesn't like this at all. He definitely doesn't think that you can draw those sorts of conclusions. And I just wonder whether maybe he would have been an advocate of the UPD had that idea been clearly articulate. I mean, just as a very brief side note, I do think that the UPD goes back possibly before Shackle. I could find ideas that look very similar to it in some of the work by Arthur Pryor from the 50s. So I think Pryor was onto the right line there. I mean, Pryor weirdly comes up with the idea of the UPD before Benedetti came up with the paradox, which another fun little fact. Anyway, so yeah, I've already forgotten what you actually asked me about. So I'm just
well,
sort of...
I can probably add to it if that's okay. Yeah. I mean, he was basically asking like if there were more costs to causal finitism as a solution. And you know, one thing that Alex was just emphasizing is that it seems to be incredibly metaphysically profligate. It just seems to be incredibly unsimple. It seems to commit us to this vast program of like spatiotemporal finitism, and you know, we argue for this in quite some depth in the paper if people are curious, but like the short of it is that the way that proponents of causal finitism and temporal finitism, the view that the past must be finite, the way that these proponents often argue for causal finitism or temporal finitism by saying that if there could be infinite causal chains, then you could have these Benedetti paradoxes. Or if there could be an infinite past, then you could have these Benedetti paradoxes. The way that they argue for that equally transfers over to these claims about if there could be continuous space. Like if space could be infinitely divisible, then you could get a Benedetti paradox. If time could be infinitely divisible, then you could get a Benedetti paradox. If space could be infinite in extent, then you could get a Benedetti paradox, as Alex was just explaining. You could just line the Reapers up in a line and so on. So if you really are going to be convinced by these arguments to go in for causal finitism, it seems like you should then be committed to this just vast, wildly profligate program of like spatial termofinism, just from the armchair, like the physicists, you know, it might be an open question for the physicists that space is like infinite in extent, but here you are, this metaphysician reflecting on this one paradox, proclaiming from your armchair that space is not only finite in extent, but necessarily finite in extent. There is no possible world in which space is infinite in extent. Same thing with the infinite divisibility of space and time. You could just sit in your armchair and just relax and be like, ah, yes, I reflected on this one paradox, and now I just pierce into the a priori forms and see that you know, space must be finitely divisible and time must be, and like, again, these are claims of necessity. So it just seems incredibly metaphysically profligate. That's one of the problems. The second thing that is a cost of causal finitism is that precisely in virtue of this metaphysical profligacy, it seems to conflict with various modal epistemological tools, that is, various devices or tools that we use to infer or justify claims about what's possible. So, like, it's very standard fare in metaphysics to argue for the possibility of something by virtue of the fact that we can, say, conceive of it, and that it's, like, totally seemingly consistent, and that it figures in, like, physically live models of, like, cosmological reality and so on. If these things at least provide some reason to think that what we conceive of is possible, or that what is consistent is possible, or that what figures in some physically live hypotheses is possible, well, then we can just infer that we have some reason to think that, you know, an infinite past is possible, because that's totally conceivable. We have some reason to think that, you know, space is possibly infinite in extent, because that's totally conceivable. Same thing with the infinite divisibility of time, infinite divisibility of space. So, like, the very often these modal epistemological tools that philosophers elsewhere rely on, if they have any weight whatsoever, then they're going to be counting against causal finitism, because they equally motivate claims to the effect of a lot of these spatiotemporal structures are actually possible. So that's the second thing. And then just finally, before I turn it over to whoever wants to add, the third thing, and this is, I think, pretty serious, is that causal finitism actually isn't a unifying solution to these Benedetti paradoxes. So I'll explain why that's the case in one second. But very briefly, I also want to say why it's important to have a unifying solution. So, like, here's an obviously bad solution to Benedetti paradoxes. When you confront this Reaper thing, the Reaper paradox, and you say, well, maybe there just can't be, like, Grim Reapers. That's the solution. There just can't be Grim Reapers. Okay, that is silly, right? That's just silly, because we can get the paradox with other entities. Like, we can use gods or angels or, like, disembodied souls or even, like, people, you know, like, people spread throughout an infinite past. So, like, it's a terrible solution to the Benedetti paradoxes to say that Reapers are impossible. Like, okay, that kills this one particular Benedetti paradox with Reapers. But, like, you get an obviously identical kind of paradox just by substituting Reapers with other things. So that would be a bad solution. And that kind of illustrates why it's important to have a unifying solution. We want to get to the core of these sorts of things. What's actually driving these paradoxes? What do they have in common? That's like the ideal for our solution. But crucially, causal finitism does not offer a unifying solution. And that's because we can get thoroughly non-causal variants of Benedetti paradoxes. So instead of, let's say, remember Dan gave the example of infinitely many Reapers spread throughout the infinite past, each of which does something if and only if none of the previous Reapers do something. And as that spelled out, one way to cash that out is that, well, each of the Reapers, like, checks on what the other Reapers did by either checking the state of a particle or checking something, and so they're kind of causally sensitive in that way. But here's another way that we could just articulate the paradox. This is part of the story. It's actually just a brute fact about the Reapers that they satisfy this biconditional to do something if and only if another previous ones do. They don't, like, check anything. They're not causally sensitive to the states of the previous Reapers. It's just some sort of brute fact about them. This is a Benedetti paradox. It's paradoxical precisely because it satisfies that jointly unsatisfiable pair that we mentioned earlier. Each of the Reapers does something if and only if none of the previous Reapers do, and there are infinitely many of them, beginninglessly. So this is a Benedetti paradox, but notice that causal finitism can't solve it. For all causal finitism says, this paradox could arise. And that's because, again, like I said, the states of the entities are not sensitive causally to the states of the other entities. Now, of course, you can always add auxiliary hypotheses to kill the additional paradoxes that your solution doesn't kill. So you could say, well, maybe like brute facts are impossible or something. But again, you're just like making your solution incredibly disunified, totally inelegant, obviously not getting to the core of the paradox. And I think it's pretty clear once you recognize what they're having to do, the UPD is really getting to the heart of things, and causal finitism is not. You have to supplement it with these additional theses. And notice, again, before I turn it over, I'm so excited about these things, so I gotta talk about it. Notice that, like, the person who says Reapers are impossible can also supplement their view. They can say, well, okay, like, maybe gods are impossible too, and so you can't get the paradox with gods. But it's like... okay, but maybe angels are impossible. Okay, but again, it's not a good solution. It's not unifying. It's inelegant, and they're just sort of postulating these things sort of on a one-by-one basis.
Or typewriters.
Not getting to the heart. What'd you say?
I said, so you can formulate the paradox in terms of typewriters, right? Like the typewriters that write on a piece of paper only if no typewriter has written. And now they'd have to say that typewriters are impossible.
Right. No, exactly. So yeah, that's not the causal finitist, of course. When we say they, it's like the person who's, saying that, well, we'll solve it by saying Reapers are impossible. But that's just like for the audience, that's a dramatization of the badness of having a disunified, inelegant solution to Benedetti paradoxes that does not get to their core. And causal finitism does not get to their core. And even causal finitism, as we point out in a footnote, together with denying brute facts, that also doesn't get to it, because we can have a kind of non-causal explanatory relation between the states of the entities. Those are three, in summary, those are three big problems for the causal finitist solution, that it's much more metaphysically costly than the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis. It commits you to this super... broad program of spatiotemporal finitism. The second problem is that thereby it conflicts with a lot of our best modal epistemological tools. And thirdly, it's not a unifying solution to Benedetti paradoxes. It does not get to the heart of them. And I think those are three excellent, excellent reasons to adopt the UPD over causal finitism.
So before we get to the criticisms of the UPD, I just want to throw one thing at Dan, actually, because when you explain some of those... grand metaphysical claims that causal finitists are making, some of them seem less grand to me. Like the idea that space-time might be discrete, I think it's a pretty popular view in physics today. But the idea that the universe is finite is definitely not. Like it's certainly, Victor Alex Wilenkin will tell you that the bubbles of inflation are infinite in extent.
So, so
how do you feel about this, Dan?
Yeah, so we have at least, I mean, there are several different live hypotheses according to which space-time is discrete, and these go back a long way, but the two that are most popular today, I think, are loop quantum gravity and causal set theory. I think it's worth keeping in mind that even though those are popular ideas to explore, that doesn't mean that they are themselves probable. So this is a mistake that sometimes people make, is they think, oh, look, there's this option that we ought to take seriously. Therefore, we ought to think that it's probable. People say that kind of thing about cosmological models quite often, for example. But one reason that it's obviously wrong is that if you have some domain in which people are exploring a variety of different hypotheses, and you think that all of those hypotheses are worth taking seriously, or at least... you know, that there's none that are like tremendously more probable than any of the others. Well, as long as there's more than two of them, then the probability that you ought to assign to any one of them ought to be less than 50%. So, and by the way, the other mistake some people sometimes make that's related is they sometimes think that if you show that a whole bunch of hypotheses are individually improbable, that therefore some big class of hypotheses of which those are members are improbable, and that's not true either. And the reason to see is easy is that that's the case by just considering how lotteries work. So you know that any given lottery ticket is very unlikely to win. However, you shouldn't then conclude that there's not going to be a winning ticket, right? Like the probability there's that some ticket or other will win is the probability of the disjunction of all the tickets that could win. But the probability that any one ticket will be a winner is just the probability of that one ticket. So so I think, you know, it is worth taking seriously hypotheses according to which space and time are discrete. I don't want to say that we have any kind of good assurance any one of those is true. The other thing that's sort of odd about taking this stuff from a a priori metaphysical argument is that even if it turned out that, say, causal set theory was the right theory about space-time, then it would be, that's not the kind of thing that you would think that you could get from the armchair, right? For a very long time, this was an empirically open question. Now we're supposing that it becomes empirically closed at some point. But, you know, that's not the kind of thing that someone should be able to just divine by thinking hard enough. It should be that you should have some contact with the world, and that's how you come to this conclusion.
Yeah, and if I could very briefly add to that, you know, the what they're committed to, at least as we argue in the paper, that they're plausibly committed to, is not just the view that space-time is discrete. It's a view that it is impossible for there to be a non-discrete space-time. It's impossible for there to be continuous spatial regions or for there to be continuous temporal regions or things like that. And that is a wildly more profligate claim space-time is in fact discrete.
And it's worth pointing out that even if some conclusion turns out to be true, it doesn't mean that every argument for that conclusion is a good argument. So with the Kalam argument more generally, it might turn out that God exists, but that the Kalam argument is not a good way of showing that. That was basically Thomas Aquinas' view, by the way. With respect to the discreteness of space-time, there's a popular view that's been in philosophy for a long time, goes back to Kripke, according to which water is necessarily H2O. When we discovered the chemical formula of water, we weren't just discovering a fact about the actual world, we were discovering a fact about what water is like in any possible world in which water appears. You might think that something like that is true about space-time. You might think, well, space-time turns out to have certain kinds of features in the actual world, and we discover that through scientific inquiry, then it might turn out that space-time is necessarily discrete. But that doesn't mean that these Bernardini paradoxes provide us good reasons to think that space-time is necessarily discrete.
Right, and even if our own kind of, you know, the space-time that actually exists, me rigidly designating that, even if that thing is, supposing it's a thing, even if that thing is essentially such that it's discrete, these arguments are going to be committing not just to not just to that, but thinking that even any other space-time, numerically distinct from the space-time that we have, would also have to be discrete. So they're basically saying it's not just an essential feature of our space-time, but like space-time as such, as a kind, which is a far more metaphysically profligate claim.
To go back to Kripke, Kripke has this example where, what does he call it? What is this thing that's like?
Are you talking about Putnam's
water?
You know, XYZ.
Is it Putnam's?
XYZ instead of water.
Yeah, right. So I guess Putnam makes this example that, like, we imagine this other possible world where there's the substance that looks exactly like water, but it's a different chemical formula, call it XYZ. That doesn't conflict with the idea that water is necessarily H2O. And likewise, if it turned out that space-time is necessarily discrete, that wouldn't conflict with the idea that there could be Schmeisheim or something, right? Some other thing that looks exactly like space-time does, but that isn't discrete, right? And what Bernardini paradox would ask us to rule out is that there's any possibility even like that.
Hmm. So, Alex, let's move on a little bit. I think in the new paper, tell me if I've got this right, what you really are doing here, because these issues have been discussed elsewhere, right? The unsatisfiable paradigmosis versus causal finitism. But in the new paper, you sort of respond to some of the criticisms that the causal finitists allege at the UPD. So can you tell us, like, what are these criticisms and how do you respond?
Yeah, okay. So it's true that the Benedetti paradox and the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis have been grouped together. The causal finitism and the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis really haven't been pitched together in the literature, discussed very tangentially by Proust. That's about it. Shackle doesn't know anything. We've spoken to Shackle. He'd no idea about this philosophy of religion debate, never heard of this causal finitist program or anything. So what Shackle was doing was, there was a phase starting in the early 90s by logicians, basically Stephen Yablo, Roy Sorensen, Graham Priest, people like that. And they were, it's because Yablo was interested in the liar paradox, but he was trying to come up with a version of it that didn't involve circularity. So he basically independently cooked up a Benedetti paradox. And that's what all the logicians spent like about 10 years, all the logicians, what am I talking about? A bunch of logicians spent. So, you know, there's a bit of the literature anywhere, there's you know, about 15 papers or so, people discussing this. Right? And so we're taking the insights that were gained from that. It seems to me, or certainly seems to us anyway, that Shackle's paper kind of ends that with the right analysis. But that lesson hadn't really been fully taken on board in this philosophy of religion discussion, which is a lot more metaphysical and less formal. So what we're doing is applying, we're really defending the output of that logical analysis to the philosophy of religion discussion. Now, as you point out, there is a couple of standard objections, as sort of standard objections to this. I guess we could do one each, right? The first one is the mysterious force objection. So I'll talk about that, and then Joe, you can talk about the patchwork objection afterwards, if that works for you.
Okay, sounds good. So,
yeah, the mysterious force objection is put by a number of people. Proust comes to mind, and this other guy, Lorenzo Luna, puts this, but you see it in a number of different people as well. I think Kunz is running it as well these days. But the way this goes is, if you picture some sequence, right, a never beginning sequence of, let's say, reapers, right, each of which wants to kill Fred, if and only if none of the earlier ones have. Now, obviously, it can't actually happen, because there's a contradiction that takes place if that, you know, in that series. But the mysterious force objection to the UPD is going to say something like, look, if you had that sequence, so let's say there's infinitely many reapers, right? Well, which one is it that doesn't kill Fred, right? If and only if all the ones, none of the ones before him did that. Like, at some point, one of them must not obey that rule, right? And kind of let Fred live or something. And unless there's some causal explanation there why that doesn't happen, it just seems like some kind of mysterious force. Like, how come? Like, each of the reapers is individually possible, it seems. Them obeying the rule individually seems possible. How come you can't just have loads and loads of them lined up, right? How come if one of them, it's certainly possible to have one reaper who thinks to himself, were there any other reapers? And I would kill Fred if and only if none of the other ones had, right? That seems completely reasonable. Maybe you could have two, right? And that's fine too. And then you could have three, no problem. Four, that's cool. But if you try and have infinitely many, all of a sudden there's a contradiction. But the thought is, well, what's to stop you just adding another one and another one, right? For none of them are you forbidden to like add him to the group, right? So it seems like the UPDist wants to say you can't have all of them, but there doesn't really seem to be any kind of causal prohibition against it. So it's a bit like, if you know, the grandfather paradox, is it like a bit similar to this, right? So if you were to be able to go back in time, you could like potentially train how to use a rifle and lie in wait and kill your great grandfather as he's on the way to work, right? Now, obviously you can't successfully kill him, because then you wouldn't have been born and wouldn't have gone back in time to do it in the first place. But on the other hand, it does seem like you can, because, you know, it's easy to train reasonably well on a rifle, and let's say it's a calm day and you've got an unobstructed sight or whatever. So David Lewis famously put forward this idea that that something will happen, you'll slip on a banana skin or something, right? But there's you know, it split the kind of philosophical audience in half, with a lot of people agreeing with him and a lot of people disagreeing. The disagreement comes about by thinking, well, what are you saying, that there's some like time lord that like chaperones the time traveler and like prevents him from carrying out this otherwise possible action, right? Is that what you're saying, Lewis, right? Because that would be really implausible. And I think that's what the people who are putting forward the mysterious force objection. That's what they have in mind, is that they think, oh, there's some weird chaperone that intervenes to prevent logical contradictions from obtaining or something. And that's what, as if that's what we're saying. And so they're sort of saying the UPD is committed to this mysterious force intervening and preventing contradictions from appearing. I think I'm trying to state the objection as charitably as I can. I don't think it's a stupid objection. I totally feel the intuition tug. Certainly when you come to the time travel case, there is something a bit weird about that. Nevertheless, I don't think it works in this case. And this, I think it's a really clear way of explaining why. So this is an example we got from this paper by Barron and Colvin. Colvin? I think it's Colvin. That's how you say it.
I don't know. Colvin? I don't know.
Colvin, yeah, whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, there's a Y. You
can read our paper then. In the rest. There's a Y, yeah. So Colvin. Anyway, whatever. So they have this example where just, you know, picture Bridget, and she's trying to cross each of the seven bridges of Königsberg without doubling back on herself, right? And this, it was a sort of puzzle, mathematics puzzle from the 1700s that Euler solved when he was a kid, I think. And basically, it's the beginning of graph theory, and the idea is these bridges of Königsberg make a non-Eulerian circuit, whatever. The point is that you can formally show why she can't go across all of those bridges without doubling back on herself, right? It's simply impossible. Fundamentally, it's mathematically impossible or logically impossible. There's just a contradiction involved in any of the pathways that involve her doing that. So it's simply not possible. But now think about like how strange it would be to suppose that you must be committed to there being a mysterious force that prevents her from completing that task, right? It's not as if somebody, you know, she's just about to step over the last bridge and then like the Time Lord comes in and sweeps her off her feet or something. That's certainly not what Euler is suggesting, and nor is it needed to make sense of his proof that it's an impossible task, right? It's simply graph theory says you can't do it, or it's impossible because it's a contradiction. It's the most simple way of putting it. And so it just seems to me that, like, if you're happy with those types of mathematical proofs showing that something is impossible without the need to invoke some mysterious causal force, kind of controlling and making sure everything sticks in line with that, then the same thing should be true in this case as well, right? It's just the case that you can't have both an infinite sequence of reapers and that they all obey this rule where they will do X if and only if none of the previous ones have, right? It can't obtain. It's just as the same way that Bridget can't complete her path without doubling back on herself. Now, am I committed to one of the reapers thereby, you know, being naughty and not following the rule or something? I mean, not in particular, right? I'm not going to say, you know, the reaper number 317, he's the one who's going to not follow the rule. Anything specific like that, just as I'm not committed to, you know, on bridge number 3, Bridget's going to slip on a banana skin and fall into the river. I'm not committed to that any specific thing actually obtaining. It's just that something will happen if she tries to cross all of the bridges, like her getting bored or her falling into the water or something. But certainly it won't be that she completes the task. Same thing here. I'm not committed to any of the reapers in particular failing to obey the rule. It's just that they can't all do that, right? So, and it just seems to me that the mysterious force objection, maybe it seems good, it's kind of like an intuition pump thing to it that can capture the imagination, but it just seems to me that when you think it through clearly, I'm not under any obligation to give you a number of a reaper and then specific. It's like I'm saying that the possible world in which you have an infinite sequence of reapers and they all obey the rule is actually contradictory. So it's an impossible world. And then me refusing to say what would happen if I tried to set the scenario up. It's just like me saying, well, I can't tell you what the closest, most similar possible world is to that impossible world, right? There may be no settled answer to that question. It's just not my problem. I don't care what, if there's a closest possible world or not. I'm just, you know, it's not my problem. I don't have to show you that in order to establish that this world is impossible, right? So that's a slightly more technical way of putting it, but this is like cashing out in terms of like, give me the closest possible world. That's what I think the people who are putting this objection forwards are saying, and that's just like wrong-headed. I'm just because I'm saying that these propositions are jointly and unsatisfiable, thereby any world that manifests them would be an impossible world, doesn't mean that I can say, oh, this is the world right next to that one, where, you know, it's only one atom difference from this thing. That's not part of what I'm saying.
But yeah, and if I can just add something, I mean, just go back to the taxi paradox. I mean, it's like, oh, are we committed to some mysterious ghostly force, logical chaperone that's like preventing all these things from coordinating together in such a way? I mean, like, imagine that God incarnates as a person, and the person is revealing to me, like, you know, as stated in the story, like, you haven't gotten into a taxi. Now, there are lots of quote unquote nearby possible worlds, you know, like one where all the same events transpire, but instead of saying you haven't gotten into a taxi, like Jesus says to me, you haven't gotten into a taxiderm or something like that. You know, that's what Jesus says. Or like, instead of saying you haven't gotten into a taxi, it's like you have gotten into a taxi. It's like, well, you know, the exact same story can play out, and like, you can add just DERM at the end of God's revelation. So like, what's preventing, you know, is there some spooky mysterious force that's preventing the contradiction from arising? And like, all these things are individually possible, you know, like God can reveal to me, like, there's some possible world, let's say, in which God reveals to me that you know, I've never gotten into a taxi, so that's individually possible. Is there some logical chaperone that's preventing me from like adding into that previous world, like in the past, me getting into a taxi? Oh, what's stopping it? It's like, This is not a good objection.
Joe, can you go to the next objection about the patchwork principle? Can you explain what is this patchwork principle?
Yeah, so it's a bit technical, and it's difficult to explain. I will try my best. So the basic idea is that proponents of causal finitism, or maybe temporal finitism, or some other finitist thesis, they want to have this premise that, hey, if there could be infinite causal chains, then you could get a Benedetti paradox. Or if there could be an infinite past, then you could get a Benedetti paradox. Let's focus on the infinite past one for simplicity. And so how do you motivate that claim? Well, this is another way that you could try to motivate that claim by saying, the claim again is that if you could have an infinite past, then you could have Benedetti paradoxes. And the way that they try to motivate that claim is by appeal to the Patrick principle. Now, let me just say, how would this claim, if true, how would this claim challenge the UPD? Well, if this claim is true, if there could be an infinite past, then there could be a Benedetti paradox. Well, not a second. There can't be Benedetti paradoxes because they're contradictory, right? So then it would follow that you can't have infinite pasts, and so you'd get temporal finitism. And so in order to solve Benedetti paradoxes satisfactorily, we'd basically have to take on board temporal finitism. Okay, so, and that is, of course, directly challenging the UPD, which says that we don't need such a substantive metaphysical hypothesis in order to solve the paradoxes. Okay, so again, we've got that conditional claim, and they try to justify that conditional claim by appealing to what's called the Patrick principle. There are various different formulations of this. They trace back at least to David Lewis, but you know, it's arguable that they also trace back to people like David Hume, because David Hume said that there are no necessary connections between distinct, spatially non-overlapping things. So it's not like the existence of my water bottle forces there to be, let's say, the Andromeda galaxy. You can have one without the other. You can have the other without the one. So it's going back to this idea that there are no necessary connections between basically spatially and temporally separate things. So the Patrick principle, as stated, just says that whenever you have individually possible things like my water bottle or the Andromeda galaxy, well, then they can possibly, you can basically possibly recombine them and rearrange them in whichever way you please. So if it's possible for there to be a water bottle and it's possible for there to be an Andromeda galaxy, then it's possible to sort of rearrange them in such a way that you have a water bottle next to an Andromeda galaxy. Or if it's possible for there to be a dragon and it's possible for there to be a centaur, then there's a possible world in which the dragon is like right next to the centaur, and that sort of thing. And we can rearrange things as well. So like my laptop is here and my mic is here. But by the Patrick principle, we can rearrange individually possible things in basically whichever way we please. And so there's going to be some other possible world in which these two basically have swapped places, in which my laptop is instead here and my microphone is instead over there. So yeah, the Patrick principle,
in short. Let me just interrupt for 1 second. Just in relevance to this argument, would it be fair to describe it as saying, if you will allow me one Grim Reaper and you allow me a second Grim Reaper, then you should be allow me all the Grim Reapers if you're going to consider an infinite past. Is that?
Yeah, that's basically the thrust of it. So they basically say, so long as there's a possible world with enough kind of space-time room to be able to fit the arrangement, then we can basically take, yeah, an individual Reaper and duplicate it and recombine it in a certain way such that it populates the infinite past, so that there are actually infinitely many Reapers spanning the infinite past. And we suppose that each Reaper sort of intrinsically has its ability and commitment to kill Fred if and only if none of the previous ones do. And so then the thought is that we then get a Benedetti paradox. So yeah, that's the basic thrust of the reasoning. It's basically saying Reapers are individually possible. It's individually possible for a Reaper to like successfully commit to doing something if and only if no previous Reaper does. And so long as there's a space-time with enough room to fit a certain arrangement of infinitely many of these individually possible Reapers, stretching back into the infinite past, by the Patrick principle, we can infer that there actually is a possible world in which all those infinitely many Grim Reapers coexist together. We can sort of rearrange those individually possible things in that way. But that, of course, is a Benedetti paradox. And so our initial assumption is mistaken, our assumption that there could be a possible world with enough space-time to be able to fit this arrangement. And so there can't be an infinite past. That's the basic sort of reasoning.
Right. So what's now, wrong with that reasoning? Like in the paper you go, you give some criticism.
Everything. Everything is wrong with it. No, I'm kidding. So, I mean, Alex actually sent me a picture when he saw that I gave a kind of citation dump, because I've published a number of papers criticizing this argument in so many different ways. Alex and I, in our 2023 article in Phil Studies, develop a criticism of this kind of reasoning based on this metaphysical hypothesis called branching actualism. We don't need to get into that, but basically the Patrick principle actually conflicts with independently plausible or independently motivated views about the metaphysics of modality. So that's one thing that we say. Another thing is that there's...
Joe, I don't think... No, everyone will know what we mean by metaphysics of modality. So you're talking about possible worlds, right? What's possible, what is not possible?
Yeah, exactly. They're basically views about what it is in virtue of which something is possible. That's basically what we're talking about. And some plausible views about that conflict with the Patrick principle. So that's one criticism that we raise. Another criticism, and I'll get briefly, I'll talk about what we raise in the paper, but I just want to mention these for the audience. So we raise that branching actualist criticism in our Phil Studies paper in 2023. In my single authored mind article, I raise a kind of endless future parody. We can equally use the Patrick principle to infer that the future must come to an end. In my 2024 Synthes article, I argue that Patrick principles actually don't work to license the inference that there actually is a paradox in the patched together world, because that actually requires certain extrinsic facts to obtain, which the Patrick principle doesn't allow you to infer. In my forthcoming article in the Journal of Philosophy with Troy Dana from Fiction Philosophy, we develop two objections to this, one of which we actually develop like a finite Benedetti paradox that runs in a circle, and you can use Patrick principles to develop that. To infer the possibility of that, which is of course absurd. And of course we also argue therein that the assumption about the realized powers and dispositions of Reapers being intrinsic, which is required for this argument, is actually a mistaken assumption. So anyway, there are lots of different objections to this, and you can probably put all these papers, they're available in my Phil Papers profile, you can probably put all them in the description. So that's what we don't consider in the paper. We just put all those aside. And we say we'll develop a separate problem for the kind of Patrick objection to the UPD. And the basic thought is that unrestricted Patrick principles, so without putting any restrictions on them, saying like anything can coexist with anything, you know, those are very implausible and they face pretty significant challenges. So, for instance, as Alexander Proust himself points out, they arguably conflict with theism. So like, you know, theism, there's an individually possible region which just contains a creature experiencing excruciating suffering for, let's say, an hour. And by the Patrick principle, we can actually just populate a possible world solely with just excruciating pain. No goods accrue therefrom. And it's just billions upon billions upon billions of years and billions upon billions of light years of just pure agony and suffering. And it seems like if God exists, God would never actualize that sort of world. That sort of world just doesn't seem to be compatible with God's goodness. And so, given the Patrick principle, that's going to be a possible world. And so theism is going to be possibly false. And at least traditional theism says that God would necessarily exist if he exists at all. And so if God possibly doesn't exist, it follows that God actually doesn't exist. So anyway, it conflicts with theism, conflicts with lots of other independently motivated hypotheses. And I mean, so that's just one objection. Like, the Patrick principle itself is not particularly plausible, at least by my lights. Now, of course, you could try to restrict the Patchwork principle in various ways. You could say, well, we can infer that the patched together world is possible, provided that it meets some other conditions. So, like, provided that, you know, it's not incompatible with God, provided that, you know, like, all these, you add all these provisos. So you're sort of restricting the Patrick principle. You're not making it have as many crazy commitments. And then what we argue in the paper is that, well, if you're going to add those restrictions, then you should also add a consistency respecting restriction. You should basically say that just as you shouldn't be able to infer a world, the possibility of a world which is, like, let's say, incompatible with God's existence, you also shouldn't be able to infer the possibility of a world which is inconsistent. And we motivate this inconsistency respecting proviso in various different ways. We give two separate independent arguments in the paper for it, and we also raise it as a kind of undercutting defeater, which basically just says that we actually don't need to positively justify the claim that this proviso should be included. The burden is actually on the proponents of the Patrick objection to justify that it shouldn't be included. And they have no one so far has undertaken that task. So anyway, we give arguments for this, the inclusion of this proviso. And of course, how does that relate to, how does that diffuse the objection? Well, if we do include this proviso, then we actually can't infer, we actually can't use the Patrick principle to infer the possibility of a Benedetti paradox, right? Because it violates that consistency respecting proviso. The patched together world, the world containing the Benedetti paradox, is not consistent. So anyway, that's another sort of objection to this patchwork style of response to the UPD. Like I said, there are lots of others, and we talk about it more in the paper, and we go over objections, but we probably don't have time for that here.
No, we have gone over an hour, so I want to go in a little bit further, but maybe bring things to a close not too soon, not too far from now. Alex, any other thoughts on problems with the patchwork principle?
Well, when Joe had a conversation with Rob Coons on some YouTube channel, was it Capturing Christianity or something?
No, so that was on Intellectual Catholicism, I think it's called, with Swan Sona. And you and I, we actually had a discussion afterwards to talk about that. And that was, of course, before I'd written any of these papers. So,
yeah, but so in that, Coons thought, I mean, you outlined the basic position you just said there, basically, about, like, well, any application of the patchwork principle that leads you to, I mean, basically the patchwork principle is a sort of principle in the epistemology of modality, right? So modality being about what's possible and what's impossible, etc. And this is supposed to be a tool that enables us to come to know which things are true and which things are not true, right? So it's about the epistemology of modality. But it obviously leads, it's like a guide that's walking you through an unfamiliar landscape. But obviously the guide is not a reliable guide if he walks you towards logically inconsistent possible worlds, basically. That's the idea. So it's like you shouldn't trust it. It's like a not a good epistemological guide if it's misfiring in that type of way. And so it just seems completely sensible to say, okay, I'll hire a guide that will show me around this strange land, but not one of those ones that routinely leads you into the swamp or whatever. Like, that's what we're trying to say. So, like, you obviously would weed those ones out. Those guides are bad guides, and we're not interested in them. So when Joe put the problem a bit like that to Coons, he seemed to think it was, trivial or something, that, like, because we're committed to the law of non-contradiction, then there's nothing else to say. We don't need to add a proviso on explicitly saying, any possible world that this thing leads you to, if that's inconsistent, then it's a bad guide or something. He just thought, well, you know, the law of non-contradiction takes care of this, so it doesn't matter. And I just think that that's wrong. Like, yeah, sure, you're committed to the law of non-contradiction being true. So are we, certainly for the purposes of this dialectic, right? We both agree on that. So where's the disagreement? And the thought is just that, like, the guide isn't constrained by the law of non-contradiction, right? Like, you could have a principle that you use to come to know things, which then is, you find out, is inconsistent. That's totally possible. That can definitely happen. The fact that the law of non-contradiction is true doesn't stop that from happening. Like the way that a legal system could pass two laws that are inconsistent with each other, right? That says that you can vote if you're over 16, but also you can't vote unless you're over 18. Now, what do you do if you're 17? You both can vote and you can't vote. Contradiction. The world doesn't explode when that happens, right? It's just, you know, we've written down some propositions on some parchment and put it in the Houses of Parliament or something, and those two propositions contradict one another. And the patchwork principle could just be like that, right? It's just, it can lead you towards inconsistencies. And it's no good just saying, yeah, but I think the law of non-contradiction is true. That doesn't help, right? That doesn't prevent Parliament from passing consistent laws. And so it seems to me the same thing here. I think, okay, he was talking off the top of his head, so maybe it was a first pass reply to what Joe was saying, but it did seem to me that missed the point. He thought we were missing the point. No surprise. I think he was missing the point when he said that we were missing the point.
Right. And just very briefly, you know, I think the response that the detractor of the UPD is going to make is that, you know, it's not the Patrick principle itself which is leading to, you know, the contradictory results. It's the Patrick principle together with the assumption for reductio, you know, that there is possibly an infinite past, you know, a possible world with enough space-time room to be able to accommodate this sort of arrangement. And I think that's a sensible response, but it also doesn't seem to address the two independent arguments basically in the paper that we give for including the consistency respecting proviso. So anyway, for people who have that response, or for people who this response is in the back of their heads, just check out the paper, because we talk about the proviso in more detail. And of course, like I said, we also put it in terms of an undercutting defeater. That is, something that removes someone else's justification for making a certain claim or for a certain view that they have. So like, we don't even technically speaking need to positively motivate the inclusion of this proviso. The proponent of the sort of Patrick argument is the one who needs to rule it out.
Dan, any thoughts on this patchwork principle?
Yeah, well, so from my perspective, it's just always seemed kind of odd that someone wouldn't go for the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis as opposed to going for causal finitism. So the thing that's really strange about someone who would choose causal finitism over the UPD is that we don't reason this way in general, right? So if I'm doing a mathematical proof, like suppose I complete the proof that there's the square root of 2 is an irrational number. In other words, there's no two integers whose ratio is equal to the square root of 2. Well, I don't then conclude, for example, that there are no rational numbers, right? I conclude, well, there couldn't be two rational numbers that exist in this way, but there could be two rational numbers that exist in these other ways, right? That, for instance, 0.5 has is equal to a ratio of 2 integers. In fact, it's equal to an infinite number of different ratios of 2 integers. So likewise, sure, you can come up with ways that there couldn't be infinite collections, but that doesn't tell you at all about whether or not there could be other ways that there could be infinite collections. I think what the UPD makes really clear is that is precisely that point, that yeah, you can certainly can put together impossible situations. But that doesn't tell you anything about the possibility of other situations that have one of those features. So, but by the way, there's something that I like about the paper that Joe did with Troy that didn't really, I think, come through in this conversation. Maybe it got mentioned and I zoned out at some point, but it was just this point that there are finite arrangements that are also contradictory, from which you wouldn't draw an infinitist solution, right? You wouldn't say, oh, because these finite arrangements of things are impossible, therefore you couldn't have infinite collections. Sorry, you couldn't have finite collections, rather, that all collections have to be infinite in that case. You know, rather, what you would say is, oh, that's a way that you couldn't have a finite collection. But that doesn't tell you at all that you couldn't have finite collections in other ways.
Right. No, I think that's an excellent point. And that goes back to the fact that causal finitism and temporal finitism and any other finitist thesis that you want to add is not a unifying solution to Benedetti paradoxes. Because, this is a really good point. I wish I'd have brought this up earlier, because, again, just as earlier, I was articulating a non-causal variant of Benedetti paradoxes. And I also gave a kind of non-causal, I gave one which involved a kind of brute facts, brute correlations, but another one involves a kind of non-causal explanatory dependence. You can also get Benedetti, or at least Benedetti-like paradoxes, that are thoroughly finite in character that don't involve infinities. And that's what we do in the paper. You can just have a loop of, let's say, light bulbs. each of which is on, if and only if none of the leftward ones are on, or something like that. And that you actually get basically the exact same sort of contradiction. It's not a linearly ordered sequence, but nevertheless, it does satisfy analogs of the two conditions that we mentioned earlier. It's beginningless in the sense that, you know, there's no like element which stops and doesn't have another element to the left of it. And each member of the collection satisfies some predicate, if and only if none of the ones in the direction of beginninglessness satisfy it. So again, there's this common unifying core to it, and you won't be able to kill it with the finitist solutions, because it's like thoroughly finite in character. It's just like finitely many bulbs. So yeah, that's yet another reason to think that we should really be going with something like the UPD and not causal finitism or temporal finitism or some other finitist hypothesis.
I'm going to say one last thing on this is we're not saying that causal finitism is false, right? It could be that it's true for all that the argument in the paper shows. It's not that either causal finitism is true or the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis is true. They could both be true. They're not an unsatisfiable pair between the two of them. And you may have rationally compelling reasons to adopt causal finitism anyway, that, as it were, occur to you prior to thinking about Bernardeschi paradoxes, in which case you're already a committed causal finitist. Someone brings up Bernardeschi paradoxes for the first time and you think to yourself, well, that would be a problem, but I believe all causal sequences are finite or something. So at least those ones like that just go away, because I'm already committed to the first proposition out of the unsatisfiable pair being false, right? So I think that in that case, you're not compelled to reject causal finitism and embrace the unsatisfiable pair diagnosis instead. You're quite happy, you know, you can just crack on and be a causal finitist, and that's okay. What the argument is trying to show is that, like, if it's the idea that consideration of the Benedetti paradoxes should lead you to believe in causal finitism. But that's what we're disagreeing with. Like, this Benedetti paradoxes don't have metaphysical implications, basically, is the clearest way of explaining the thesis. They just don't, you don't need to think the universe is this way rather than that way in order to not worry about Benedetti paradoxes anymore. You can just sweep them away without any metaphysical claim whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm laughing because it's like, it's like when I tell people, like, I work on, you know, Benedetti paradoxes and whatnot, and they're like, ooh, that sounds interesting. It's like, what's your take? It's like, well, actually, we can't really learn anything from that. So that's like, I was like, I'm sort of engaged in this negative project, which is like, stop positing all these metaphysically profligate views when we can actually solve it very in a kind of deflationary way. But this actually leads me to the kind of a final point that I wanted to make, which is just that the UPD has important parallels elsewhere in philosophy. And I think it's just an important conceptual tool to recognize that whenever you're faced with some kind of paradox or something like that, don't so quickly just go in for saying, oh, one of like the individual conjuncts within the whole contradictory story must be impossible. You always need to beware of that sort of move, because there's another move, which is just that, no, it's the whole conjunction which is impossible. Maybe each of the individual conjuncts is possible individually. It's just that you can't have them all kind of jointly true together. So always keep that in mind and be on the lookout in philosophy of religion. This always comes up in the Kalam, but also elsewhere in philosophy, because paradoxes are of perennial philosophical interest.
Well, I think we should wrap things up there. Thank you so much, Joe, Dan, Alex. And I think hopefully we'll get Joe back on to talk about existential inertia, because Joe's collaborated with Alex on this issue, but Joe's collaborated with Dan on existential inertia. And I think this is something that hasn't been explored properly online. And hopefully we'll have you back to discuss that. So if you like this show, please like and subscribe. Any suggestions for future shows, any thoughts that you have, please leave them in the comments. And we'll see you next time on The Sci-Fi Show.